This is Captain Fred for Free Radio. In memory of the Hiroshima bombing, which happened 50 years ago, today's reading is from Hiroshima Diary, The Journal of a Japanese Physician, by Michihiko Hachiya, M.D., translated and edited by Warner Wells, M.D. It begins August 6th, 1945. The hour was early, the morning still, warm and beautiful. Shimmering leaves reflecting sunlight from a cloudless sky made a pleasant contrast with shadows in my garden as I gazed absently through wide-flung doors opening to the south. Clad in drawers and undershirt, I was sprawled on the living room floor, exhausted because I had just spent a sleepless night on duty as an air warden in my hospital. Suddenly, a strong flash of light startled me, and then another. So well does one recall little things that I remember vividly how a stone lantern in the garden became brilliantly lit, and I debated whether this light was caused by a magnesium flare or sparks from a passing trolley. Garden shadows disappeared. The view where a moment before all had been so bright and sunny was now dark and hazy. Through swirling dust, I could barely discern a wooden column that had supported one corner of my house. It was leaning crazily, and the roof sagged dangerously. Moving instinctively, I tried to escape, but rubble and fallen timbers barred the way. By picking my way cautiously, I managed to reach the roca and stepped down into my garden. A profound weakness overcame me, so I stopped to regain my strength. To my surprise, I discovered I was completely naked. How odd. Where were my drawers and undershirt? What had happened? All over the right side of my body, I was cut and bleeding. A large splinter was protruding from a mangled wound in my thigh, and something warm trickled into my mouth. My cheek was torn, I discovered, as I felt it gingerly, with the lower lip laid wide open. Embedded in my neck was a sizable fragment of glass, which I matter-of-factly dislodged, and with the detachment of one stunned and shocked, I studied it and my blood-stained hand. Where was my wife? Suddenly, thoroughly alarmed, I began to yell for her. Yako-san! Yako-san! Where are you? Blood began to spurt. Had my carotid artery been cut, would I bleed to death? Frightened and irrational, I called out again. It's a 500-ton bomb. Yako-san, where are you? A 500-ton bomb has fallen. Yako-san, pale and frightened, her clothes torn and bloodstained, emerged from the ruins of our house, holding her elbow. Seeing her, I was reassured. My own panic assuaged, I tried to reassure her. We'll be all right, I exclaimed. Only let's get out of here as fast as we can. She nodded, and I motioned for her to follow me. The shortest path to the street lay through the house next door, so through the house we went, running, stumbling, falling, and then running again until, in headlong flight, we tripped over something and fell sprawling into the street. Getting to my feet, I discovered that I had tripped over a man's head. Excuse me, please, I cried hysterically. There was no answer. The man was dead. The head had belonged to a young officer whose body was crushed beneath a massive gate. We stood in the street, uncertain and afraid, until a house across from us began to sway, and then with a rending motion fell almost at our feet. Our own house began to sway, and in a minute it too collapsed in a cloud of dust. Other buildings caved in or toppled. Fire sprang up and, whipped by a vicious wind, began to spread. It finally dawned on us that we could not stay there in the street, so we turned our steps toward the hospital. Our home was gone, we were wounded and needed treatment, and after all, it was my duty to be with my staff. This latter was an irrational thought. What good could I be to anyone, hurt as I was? We started out, but after 20 or 30 steps, I had to stop. My breath became short, my head pounded, and my legs gave way under me. An overpowering thirst seized me, and I begged Yako-san to find me some water. But there was no water to be found. After a little, my strength somewhat returned, and we were able to go on. I was still naked, and though I did not feel the least bit of shame, I was disturbed to realize that modesty had deserted me. On rounding a corner, we came upon a soldier standing idly in the street. He had a towel draped across his shoulder, and I asked if he would give it to me to cover my nakedness. The soldier surrendered the towel quite willingly, but said not a word. A little later, I lost the towel, and Yako-san took off her apron and tied it around my loins. Our progress toward the hospital was interminably slow, until finally my legs, stiff from drawing blood, refused to carry me farther. The strength, even the will to go on, deserted me, so I told my wife, who was almost as badly hurt as I, to go on alone. This she objected to, but there was no choice. She had to go ahead and try to find someone to come back for me. Yako-san looked into my face for a moment and then, without saying a word, turned away and began running towards the hospital. Once she looked back and waved, and in a moment she was swallowed up in the gloom. It was quite dark now, and with my wife gone, a feeling of dreadful loneliness overcame me. I must have gone out of my head lying there in the road, because the next thing I recall was discovering that the clot on my thigh had been dislodged and blood was again spurting from the wound. I pressed my hand to the bleeding area, and after a while the bleeding stopped and I felt better. Could I go on? I tried. It was all a nightmare. My wounds, the darkness, the road ahead. My movements were ever so slow. Only my mind was running at top speed. In time, I came to an open space where the houses had been removed to make a fire lane. Through the dim light, I could make out ahead of me the crazy outlines of the Communications Bureau's big concrete building, and beyond it, the hospital. My spirits rose because I knew that now someone would find me, and if I should die, at least my body would be found. I paused to rest. Gradually, things around me came into focus. There were the shadowy forms of people. Some of them looked like walking ghosts. Others moved as though in pain, like scarecrows, their arms held out from their bodies with forearms and hands dangling. These people puzzled me until I suddenly realized that they had been burned and were holding their arms out to prevent the painful friction of raw surfaces rubbing together. A naked woman carrying a naked baby came into view. I averted my gaze. Perhaps they had been in the bath. But then I saw a naked man, and it occurred to me that, like myself, some strange thing had deprived them of their clothes. An old woman lay near me with an expression of suffering on her face, but she made no sound. Indeed, one thing was common to everyone I saw: complete silence. All who could were moving in the direction of the hospital. I joined in the dismal parade when my strength was somewhat recovered and at last reached the gates of the Communications Bureau. Familiar surroundings, familiar faces. There was Mr. Iguchi and Mr. Yoshihiro and my old friend Mr. Sara, the head of the business office. They hastened to give me a hand, their expressions of pleasure changing to alarm when they saw that I was hurt. I was too happy to see them to share their concern. No time was lost over greetings. They eased me onto a stretcher and carried me into the communications building, ignoring my protests that I could walk. Later, I learned that the hospital was so overrun that the Communications Bureau had to be used as an emergency hospital. The rooms and corridors were crowded with people, many of whom I recognized as neighbors. To me, it seemed that the whole community was there. My friends passed me through an open window into a janitor's room, recently converted to an emergency first aid station. The room was a shambles. Fallen plaster, broken furniture, and debris littered the floor. The walls were cracked, and a heavy steel window casement was twisted and almost wrenched from its seating. What a place to dress the wounds of the injured. To my great surprise, who should appear but my private nurse, Miss Kado, and Mr. Mizoguchi, and old Mrs. Seiki. Miss Cotto set about examining my wounds without speaking a word. No one spoke. I asked for a shirt and pajamas. They got them for me, but still no one spoke. Why was everyone so quiet? Miss Cotto finished the examination, and in a moment it felt as if my chest was on fire. She had begun to paint my wounds with iodine, and no amount of entreaty would make her stop. With no alternative but to endure the iodine, I tried to divert myself by looking out the window. The hospital lay directly opposite, with part of the roof and the third floor sunroom in plain view, and as I looked up, I witnessed a sight which made me forget my smarting wounds. Smoke was pouring out of the sunroom windows. The hospital was afire. Fire, I shouted. Fire, fire, the hospital is on fire. My friends looked up. It was true. The hospital was on fire. The alarm was given, and from all sides people took up the cry. The high-pitched voice of Mr. Sarah, the business officer, rose above the others, and it seemed as if his was the first voice I had heard that day. The uncanny stillness was broken. Our little world was now in pandemonium. I remember that Dr. Sasada, chief of the pediatric service, came in and tried to reassure me, but I could scarcely hear him above the din. I heard Dr. Hinoy's voice and then Dr. Koyama's. Both were shouting orders to evacuate the hospital, and with such vigor that it sounded as though the sheer strength of their voices would hasten those who were slow to obey. The sky became bright as flames from the hospital mounted. Soon the bureau was threatened, and Mr. Sarah gave the order to evacuate. My stretcher was moved into a rear garden and placed beneath an old cherry tree. Other patients limped into the garden or were carried until soon the entire area became so crowded that only the very ill had room to lie down. No one talked, and the ominous silence was relieved only by a subdued rustle among so many people, restless, in pain, anxious, and afraid, waiting for something else to happen. The sky filled with black smoke and glowing sparks. Flames rose, and the heat set currents of air in motion. Updrafts became so violent that sheets of zinc roofing were hurled aloft and released, humming and twirling in erratic flight. Pieces of flaming wood soared and fell like fiery swallows. While I was trying to beat out the flames, a hot ember seared my ankle. It was all I could do to keep from being burned alive. The bureau started to burn, and window after window became a square of flame until the whole structure was converted into a crackling, hissing inferno. Scorching winds howled around us, whipping dust and ashes into our eyes and up our noses. Our mouths became dry, our throats raw and sore from the biting smoke pulled into our lungs. Coughing was uncontrollable. We would have moved back, but a group of wooden barracks behind us caught fire and began to burn like tinder. The heat finally became too intense to endure, and we were left no choice but to abandon the garden. Those who could fled, those who could not perished. Had it not been for my devoted friends, I would have died. But again they came to the rescue and carried my stretcher to the main gate on the other side of the bureau. Here a small group of people were already clustered, and here I found my wife, Dr. Sasada, and Miss Cotto joined us. Fire sprang up on every side as violent winds fanned flames from one building to another. Soon we were surrounded. The ground was held in front of the communications bureau, became an oasis in a desert of fire. As the flames came closer, the heat became more intense, and if someone in our group had not had the presence of mind to drench us with water from a fire hose, I doubt if anyone could have survived. Hot as it was, I began to shiver. The drenching was too much. My heart pounded, things began to whirl until all before me blurred. Karushi, I murmured weakly. I am done. The sound of voices reached my ears as though from a great distance, and finally became louder as if close at hand. I opened my eyes. Dr. Sasada was feeling my pulse. What had happened? Miss Cotto gave me an injection. My strength gradually returned. I must have fainted. Huge raindrops began to fall. Some thought a thunderstorm was beginning and would extinguish the fires, but these drops were capricious. A few fell and then a few more, and that was all the rain we saw. The first floor of the bureau was now ablaze, and flames were spreading rapidly towards our little oasis by the gate. Right then, I could hardly understand the situation, much less do anything about it. An iron window frame, loosened by fire, crashed to the ground behind us. A ball of fire whizzed by me, setting my clothes ablaze. They drenched me with water again. From then on, I am confused as to what happened. I do remember Dr. Hanoi because of the pain I felt when he jerked me to my feet. I remember being moved, or rather dragged, and my whole spirit rebelling against the torment I was made to endure. My next memory is of an open area. The fires must have receded. I was alive. My friends had somehow managed to rescue me again. A head popped out of an air raid dugout, and I heard the unmistakable voice of old Mrs. Seki. "Cheer up, doctor. Everything will be all right. The north side is burnt out. We have nothing further to fear from the fire." I might have been her son, the way the old lady calmed and reassured me, and indeed she was right. The entire northern side of the city was completely burned. The sky was still dark, but whether it was evening or midday, I could not tell. It might even have been the next day. Time had no meaning. What I had experienced might have been crowded into a moment or been endured through the monotony of eternity. Smoke was still rising from the second floor of the hospital, but the fire had stopped. There was nothing left to burn, I thought, but later I learned that the first floor of the hospital escaped destruction largely through the courageous efforts of Dr. Koyama and Dr. Hinoi. The streets were deserted except for the dead. Some looked as if they had been frozen by death while in the full action of flight. Others lay sprawled as though some giant had flung them to their death from a great height. Hiroshima was no longer a city, but a burnt-over prairie. To the east and to the west, everything was flattened. The distant mountains seemed nearer than I could ever remember. The hills of Yoshida and the woods of Nigitsu loomed out of the haze and smoke like the nose and eyes on a face. How small Hiroshima was with its houses gone. The wind changed and the sky again darkened with smoke. Suddenly I heard someone shout, "Planes! Enemy planes!" Could that be possible after what had happened? What was there left to bomb? My thoughts were interrupted by the sound of a familiar name. A nurse calling Dr. Katsubi. "It is Dr. Katsubi. It's him," shouted old Mrs. Seki, a happy ring to her voice. "Dr. Katsubi has come." It was Dr. Katsubi, our head surgeon, but he seemed completely unaware of us as he hurried past, making a straight line for the hospital. Enemy planes were forgotten. So great was our happiness that Dr. Katsubi had been spared to return to us. Before I could protest, my friends were carrying me into the hospital. The distance was only 100 meters, but it was enough to cause my heart to pound and make me feel sick and faint. I recall the hard table and the pain when my face and lip were sutured, but I have no recollection of the 40 or more other wounds Dr. Katsubi closed before the night. They removed me to an adjoining room, and I remember feeling relaxed and sleepy. The sun had gone down, leaving a dark red sky. The red flames of the burning city had scorched the heavens. I gazed at the sky until sleep overtook me. August 7th, 1945. I must have slept soundly because when I opened my eyes, a piercing hot sun was shining in on me. There were no shutters or curtains to lessen the glare, and for that matter, no windows. The groans of patients assaulted my ears. Everything was in a turmoil. Instruments, window frames, and debris littered the floor. The walls and ceilings were scarred and picked as though someone had sprinkled sesame seeds over their surfaces. Most of the marks had been made by slivers of flying glass, but the larger scars had been caused by hurtling instruments and pieces of window casements. Near a window, an instrument cabinet was overturned. The headpiece had been knocked off the ear, nose, and throat examining chair, and a broken sun lamp was overturned across the seat. I saw nothing that was not broken or in disorder. Dr. Sasada, who had looked after me yesterday, lay on my left. I had thought he escaped injury, but now I could see that he was badly burned. His arms and hands were bandaged, and his childish face so obscured by swelling that I would not have recognized him had it not been for his voice. My wife lay to my right. Her face was covered with a white ointment, giving her a ghostly appearance. Her right arm was in a sling. Miss Cotto, only slightly wounded, was between me and my wife. She had nursed all of us throughout the night. My wife, seeing that I was awake, turned and said, "Last night you seemed to be suffering." "Yes," said Miss Cotto, chiming in. I don't know how many you're breathing." I recognized Dr. Fuji's wife sitting motionless on a bench near the wall. Her face bore an expression of anguish and despair. Turning to Miss Cotto, I asked what the matter was, and she replied, "Mrs. Fuji was not hurt very much, but her baby was. It died during the night." "Where is Dr. Fuji?" I inquired. "Their older daughter is lost," she answered. "He's been out all night looking for her and hasn't returned." Dr. Koyama came in to inquire how we were. The sight of him, with his head bandaged and an arm in a sling, brought tears to my eyes. He had worked all night and was even now thinking of others before himself. Dr. Katsubi, our surgeon, and Miss Takeo, a surgical nurse, were with Dr. Koyama, who was now deputy director. They all looked tired and haggard, and their white clothes were dirty and blood-stained. I learned that Mr. Iguchi, our driver, had contrived to rig up an emergency operating light from a car battery and headlight with which they had managed to operate until the light went out just before day. Dr. Koyama, observing my concern, remarked, "Doctor, everything is all right." Dr. Katsubi looked me over and, after feeling my pulse, said, "You received many wounds, but they all missed vital spots." He then described them and told me how they had been treated. I was surprised to learn that my shoulder had been severely cut, but relieved at his optimism for my recovery. "How many patients are in the hospital?" I asked Dr. Koyama. "About 150, he replied. "Quite a few that have died, but there are still so many that there is no place to put one's foot down. They are packed in everywhere, even the toilets." Nodding, Dr. Katsubi added, "There are about a half dozen beneath the stairway and about 50 in the front garden of the hospital." They discussed methods for restoring order, at least to the extent of making the corridors passable. In the space of one night, patients had become packed, like the rice in sushi, into every nook and cranny of the hospital. The majority were badly burned, a few severely injured. All were critically ill. Many had been near the heart of the city, and in their efforts to flee, managed to get only as far as the communications hospital before their strength failed. Others from nearer by came deliberately to seek treatment, or because this building, standing alone where all else was destroyed, represented shelter and a place of refuge. They came as an avalanche and overran the hospital. There was no friend or relative to minister to their needs, no one to prepare their food. Everything was in disorder, and to make matters worse was the vomiting and diarrhea. Patients who could not walk urinated and defecated where they lay. Those who could walk would feel their way to the exits and relieve themselves there. Persons entering or leaving the hospital could not avoid stepping in the filth, so closely was it spread. The front entrance became covered with feces overnight, and nothing could be done, for there were no bedpans, and even if there had been, no one to carry them to the patients. Disposing of the dead was a minor problem, but to clean the rooms and corridors of urine, feces, and vomitus was impossible. The people who were burned suffered most because as their skin peeled away, glistening raw wounds were exposed to the heat and filth. This was the environment patients had to live in. It made one's hair stand on end, but there was no way to help the situation. This was the pattern conversation took as I lay there and listened. It was inconceivable. "When can I get up?" I asked Dr. Katsubi. "Perhaps I can do something to help." "Not until your sutures are out," he answered, "and that won't be for at least a week." With that to think about, they left me. I was not left long with my thoughts. One after another, the staff came in to express their concern over my injuries and to wish me a speedy recovery. Some of my visitors embarrassed me, for they appeared to be as badly injured as myself. Had it been possible, I would have concealed my whereabouts. Dr. Nishimura, president of the Okayama Medical Association, came all the way from my native city, 90 miles away, to see me. He had been crew captain of the boat team when we were classmates in medical school. As soon as he saw me, tears welled up in his eyes. He looked at me a moment, then exclaimed, "I say, old fellow, you are alive. What a pleasant surprise. How are you getting along?" Without waiting for an answer, he continued, "Last night we heard that Hiroshima had been attacked by a new weapon. The damage was slight, they told us, but in order to see for myself and to lend a hand if extra physicians were needed, I secured a truck and came on down. What a frightful mess greeted us when we arrived. Are you sure you are all right?" And again, without stopping for me to reply, he went on to tell about the heartbreaking things he witnessed from the truck as he entered the city. These were the first details any of us had heard, so we listened intently. While he talked, all I could think of was the fear and uncertainty that must be preying on my old mother, who lived in the country near Okayama. When I had finished, I asked Dr. Nishimura if he would get word to my mother and also to a sister who lived in Okayama that Yako-san and I were safe. He assured me that he would, and before leaving, he also promised to organize a team of doctors and nurses to come down and help as soon as he could get them together. Dr. Tabuchi, an old friend from Yoshida, came in. His face and hands had been burned, though not badly, and after an exchange of greetings, I asked if he knew what had happened. "I was in the backyard pruning some trees when it exploded," he answered. "The first thing I knew, there was a blinding white flash of light, and a wave of intense heat struck my cheek. This was odd, I thought, when in the next instant there was a tremendous blast. The force of it knocked me clean over," he continued, "but fortunately it didn't hurt me, and my wife wasn't hurt either. But you should have seen our house. It didn't topple over, it just inclined. I have never seen such a mess. Inside and out, everything was simply ruined. Even so, we are happy to be alive, and what's more, Ryoji, our son, survived. I didn't tell you that he had gone into the city on business that morning. About midnight, after we had given up all hope that he could possibly survive in the dreadful fire that followed the blast, he came home. Listen," he continued, "why don't you come on home with me? My house is certainly nothing to look at now, but it is better than here." It was impossible for me to accept his kind offer, and I tried to decline in a way that would not hurt his feelings. "Dr. Tabuchi," I replied, "we are all grateful for your kind offer, but Dr. Katsubi has just warned me that I must lie perfectly still until my wounds are healed." Dr. Tabuchi accepted my explanation with some reluctance, and after a pause, he made ready to go. "Don't go," I said. "Please tell us more of what occurred yesterday." "It was a horrible sight," said Dr. Tabuchi. "Hundreds of injured people who were trying to escape to the hills past our house. The sight of them was almost unbearable. Their faces and hands were burnt and swollen, and great sheets of skin had peeled away from their tissues to hang down like rags on a scarecrow. They moved like a line of ants. All through the night, they went past our house, but this morning they had stopped. I found them lying on both sides of the road, so thick that it was impossible to pass without stepping on them." I lie with my eyes shut while Dr. Tabuchi was talking, picturing in my mind the horror he was describing. I neither saw nor heard Mr. Katsutani when he came in. It was not until I heard someone sobbing that my attention was attracted and I recognized my old friend. I had known Dr. Katsutani for many years and knew him to be an emotional person. But even so, to see him break down made tears come to my eyes. He had come all the way from Jigo Zen to look for me, and now that he had found me, emotion overcame him. He turned to Dr. Sasada and said brokenly, "Yesterday it was impossible to enter Hiroshima, else I would have come. Even today, fires are still burning in some places. You should see how the city has changed. When I reached the Misasa Bridge this morning, everything before me was gone, even the castle. These buildings here are the only ones left anywhere around. The Communications Bureau seemed to loom right in front of me long before I got anywhere near here." Mr. Katsutani paused for a moment to catch his breath and went on. "I really walked along the railroad tracks to get here, but even they were littered with electric wires and broken railway cars, and the dead and wounded lay everywhere. When I reached the bridge, I saw a dreadful thing. It was unbelievable. There was a man, stone dead, sitting on his bicycle as it leaned against the bridge railing. It is hard to believe that such a thing could happen." He repeated himself two or three times as if to convince himself that what he said was true, and then continued. "It seems that most of the dead people were either on the bridge or beneath it. You could tell that many had gone down to the river to get a drink of water and had died where they lay. I saw a few live people still in the water, knocking against the dead as they floated down the river. There must have been hundreds and thousands who fled to the river to escape the fire, then drowned. The sight of the soldiers, though, was more dreadful than the dead people floating down the river. I came onto I don't know how many, burned from the hips up, and where the skin had peeled, their flesh was wet and mushy. They must have been wearing their military caps because the black hair on top of their heads was not burned. It made them look like they were wearing black lacquer bowls, and they had no faces. Their eyes, noses, and mouths had been burned away, and it looked like their ears had melted off. It was hard to tell front from back. One soldier, whose features had been destroyed and was left with his white teeth sticking out, asked me for some water. But I didn't have any. I clasped my hands and prayed for him. He didn't say anything more. His plea for more water must have been his last words. The way they were burned, I wonder if they didn't have their coats off when the bomb exploded." It seemed to give Mr. Katsutani some relief to pour out his terrifying experiences on us, and there was no one who would have stopped him, so fascinating was his tale of horror. While he was talking, several people came in and stayed to listen. Somebody asked him what he was doing when the explosion occurred. "I had just finished breakfast," he replied, "and was getting ready to light a cigarette, when all of a sudden I saw a white flash. In a moment there was a tremendous blast. Not stopping to think, I let out a yell and jumped into an air raid dugout. In a moment there was such a blast as I have never heard before. It was terrific. I jumped out of the dugout and pushed my wife into it. Realizing something terrible must have happened in Hiroshima, I climbed up onto the roof of my storehouse to have a look." Mr. Katsutani became more intense and, gesticulating wildly, went on, "Towards Hiroshima, I saw a big black cloud go billowing up like a puffy summer cloud. Knowing for sure then that something terrible had happened in the city, I jumped down from my storehouse and ran as fast as I could to the military post at Hatsukaichi. I ran up to the officer in charge and told him what I had seen and begged him to send somebody to help in Hiroshima. But he didn't even take me seriously. He looked at me for a moment with a threatening expression, and then, do you know what he said? He said, 'There isn't much to worry about. One or two bombs won't hurt Hiroshima.' There was no use talking to that fool. I was the ranking officer in the local branch of the Ex-Officers Association, but even I didn't know what to do, because that day the villagers under my command had been sent off to Miyajima for labor service. I looked all around to find someone to help me make a rescue squad, but I couldn't find anybody. While I was still looking for help, wounded people began to stream into the village. I asked them what had happened, but all they could tell me was that Hiroshima had been destroyed and everybody was leaving the city. With that, I got on my bicycle and rode as fast as I could toward Itsukaichi. By the time I got there, the road was jammed with people, and so was every path and byway. Again, I tried to find out what had happened, but nobody could give me a clear answer. When I asked these people where they had come from, they would point towards Hiroshima and say, "This way." And when I asked where they were going, they would point toward Miyajima and say, "That way." Everybody said the same thing. I saw no badly wounded or burned people around Itsukaichi, but when I reached Kusatsu, nearly everybody was badly hurt. The nearer I got to Hiroshima, the more I saw, until by the time I had reached Koi, they were all so badly injured, I could not bear to look into their faces. They smelled like burning hair. Mr. Katsutani paused for a moment to take a deep breath and then continued. The air around Koi Station was not burned. The area around Koi Station was not burned, but the station and the houses nearby were badly damaged. Every square inch of the station platform was packed with wounded people. Some were standing, others lying down. They were all pleading for water. Now and then you could hear a child calling for its mother. It was a living hell, I tell you, it was a living hell. Today it was the same way. Did Dr. Hanaoka come to the hospital today, yesterday? I saw him cross the streetcar trestle at Koi and head in this direction, but I can't believe that he could have made his way through that fire. No, we haven't seen him, someone answered. Mr. Katsutani nodded reflectively and went on. I left Koi Station and went over to the Koi Primary School. By then the school had been turned into an emergency hospital and was already crowded with desperately injured people. Even the playground was packed with the dead and dying. They looked like so many codfish spread out for drying. What a pitiful sight it was to see them lying there in the hot sun. Even I could tell they were all going to die. Towards evening, I was making my way back to the highway when I ran into my sister. My sister, whose home had been in Tokaichi, must surely have been killed. But here she was, alive. She was so happy she couldn't utter a word. All she could do was cry. If ever anybody shed tears of joy, she did. Some kind people had lent me a hand in making a stretcher and helped me carry her back to my home in Jigozen near Miyajima Guchi. Even my little village, as far removed as it was from Hiroshima, had become a living hell. Every shrine, every temple was packed and jammed with wounded people. The stories of Dr. Nishimura, Dr. Tabuchi, and Mr. Katsutani left no doubt in my mind about the destruction of Hiroshima. I had seen enough to know that the damage was heavy, but what they had told me was unbelievable. When I thought of the injured, lying in the sun, begging for water, I felt as though I were committing a sin by being where I was. I no longer felt quite so sorry for those of our patients who were obliged to lie on the hard concrete floors in the toilets. My thoughts turned to myself. If only I hadn't been hurt, I mused. I could be doing something instead of laying here as a patient, requiring the attention of my comrades. Wounded and helpless, what a plight, when all about me there is so much to do. Fortunately, my dismal thoughts were interrupted. Who should make an appearance but Dr. Hanaoka, our internist, whom Mr. Katsutani had just told us was last seen at Hatsukaichi. "Dr. Hachiya, you don't know how happy I am to see you," exclaimed Dr. Hanaoka. "After seeing what has happened to Hiroshima, it's a miracle anyone survived." "We have been worrying about you, Dr. Hanaoka," I replied, "because Mr. Katsutani has just told us a few minutes ago that he saw you disappear in the direction of Hiroshima while he was at the Koi Station yesterday. Where have you been and how did you get here?" "Now that I'm here, I wonder myself," said Dr. Hanaoka. Let me tell you, if I can, what happened. Somebody told me that a special new bomb was dropped near the Gogoku Shrine. If what I was told is true, then that bomb must have had terrific power. For from the Gogoku Shrine clean out to the Red Cross Hospital, everything is completely destroyed. The Red Cross Hospital, though badly damaged, was spared, and beyond, going towards Ujina, the damage is slight. I stopped by the Red Cross Hospital on my way here. It is swamped with patients, and outside the dead and dying are lined up on either side of the street as far east as the Miyuki Bridge. Between the Red Cross Hospital and the center of the street, I saw nothing that wasn't burned to a crisp. Streetcars were standing at Kawaiya-cho and Kamiya-cho, and inside were dozens of bodies, blackened beyond recognition. I saw fire reservoirs filled to the brim with dead people who looked as though they had been boiled alive. In one reservoir, I saw a man horribly burned, crouching beside another man who was dead. He was drinking blood-stained water out of the reservoir. Even if I had tried to stop him, it wouldn't have done any good. He was completely out of his head. In one reservoir, there were so many dead people, there wasn't enough room for them to fall over. They must have died sitting in the water. Even the swimming pool at the prefectural middle school is filled with dead people. They must have suffocated while they sat in the water trying to escape the fire because they didn't appear to be burned. Dr. Hanaoka cleared his throat and after a moment continued. Dr. Hachiya, that pool wasn't big enough to accommodate everybody who tried to get in it. You could tell that by looking around the sides. I don't know how many people were caught by death with their heads hanging over the edge. In one pool, I saw some people who were still alive, sitting in the water with dead all around them. They were too weak to get out. People were trying to help them, but I am sure they must have died. I apologize for telling you these things, but they are true. I don't see how anyone got out alive. Dr. Hanaoka paused, and I could see he was anxious to get to work. With what there was to do, it would have been criminal. These visitors were telling me began to fit into a pattern. A few comments from this one, a few remarks from another, were beginning to give me a picture of what Hiroshima was like. Dr. Hanaoka had barely left, Hiyama, head of obstetrics and gynecology, came in. He was unhurt, but looked tired and worn. "Sit down and rest a few minutes," I said. "You must have been through a great deal. Where were you when the bombing occurred?" "I was just leaving my home when it went off," said Dr. Akiyama in a tremulous voice. "A blinding flash, a tremendous explosion, and over I went on my back. And then a big black cloud, such as you see in the summer before a storm, began to rise above Hiroshima. 'Yaretta!' I shouted, and that was it. What a hodgepodge was made of my house. The ceilings, the walls, the sliding doors, everything ruined beyond repair. Almost at once, injured people began to line up before my gate, and from then until a little while ago, I stayed and treated them. But my supplies are all gone, and there is nothing left to treat them with. 20 or 30 people are still lying in the house, and there is nobody to take care of them. There is nothing anybody can do unless I find some more supplies." Dr. Akiyama, ordinarily easygoing and happy, had the look of a man distraught. Dr. Koyama came in while Dr. Akiyama was talking, and so heard most of what he had been saying. "Knowing you, I can imagine what you have gone through," said Dr. Koyama. "I don't know," sighed Dr. Akiyama. "Today it's the same as it was yesterday. There is no end to that stream of miserable souls who stop at my house to ask for help. They are trying to reach Kabe, but they will never get there. There is nothing I can do, nothing anybody can do." Since Dr. Akiyama's home was in Nagatsuka, I got a general idea of what the suburb was like. The problem there was the same as in the Koi area. I could picture in my mind the wounded people walking in silence, like lost spirits, and answering, when questioned, that they had come this way and were going that way. I could see them begging for water, hear their moaning, and see them dying. I might have been there myself, so vividly had my friends recounted to me what they had seen. It was reported that none of the patients had any appetite, and that one by one they were beginning to vomit and have diarrhea. Did the new weapon I had heard about throw off a poison gas, or perhaps some deadly germ? I asked Dr. Hanaoka to confirm if he could report of vomiting and diarrhea and find out if any of the patients looked as if they might have an infectious disease. He inquired and brought word that there were many who had not only diarrhea but bloody stools, and that some had had as many as 40 to 50 stools during the previous night. This convinced me that we were dealing with a bacillary dysentery and had no choice but to isolate those who were infected. Dr. Koyama, as deputy director, has given me the responsibility of setting up an isolation ward. He chose a site on the grounds beyond the south side of the hospital, and with the help of some soldiers who happened along, he managed to construct what amounted to a crude outdoor pavilion. What we were trying to do probably was not worth much, but it helped our morale to think we were doing something. We'll continue with our reading from Hiroshima Diary. Stay tuned, it's coming up on the B-side. This is Captain Fred for Free Radio.